being clear on where you're going and being clear on why you're doing things and connecting with where you're going and being able to really concisely share it with the team is very, very important. It's been one of our key factors.
Simon Gardner. Simon is a British business leader, entrepreneur, podcaster, and speaker. He's the co-founder of Carrington West, a recruitment industry leader specializing in the recruiting of top-tier talent for projects that impact every aspect of our daily lives. Do you know, where you want to be, where you want to get to?
Well, I mean, it changes all the time. I suppose our next...
Starting out, finding out what your vision was when you were younger, did you have any idea of where you wanted to be, or were you one of these kids who just kind of went where life took them at the time?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. I mean, I remember, you know, it depends how far back you want to go, but I remember when I was... 8, 9, 10, that sort of time, I was either playing football in the street or thinking about small ways to make money.
Right.
You know, trading, you know, the early Premier League football stickers, that sort of thing. Me and my mate whose dad owned the sort
Panini.
Of corner. Panini, that's
it. I remember them.
I had a mate whose dad owned the corner shop at the end of the road, and we used to, you know, come up with harebrained ideas about, you know, various things. And then the following Saturday it was something completely different. So I think that entrepreneurial spirit has always been there. But very much sort of guilty at school and college of just falling into, you know, kind of what everyone else does, I suppose. And I, you know, ended up going to uni just through real sort of, you know, lack of kind of thought about any kind of future vision of myself. And I think, you know, that's kind of what I talk quite a bit about on my social media and in my newsletters, things like that, whereas, you know, it's very, very common for people to get 5 years, 10 years, 30 years into their post-school lives, if you like, and haven't ever really sat down and honestly thought truly about what they want to intentionally become or produce or do, you know, 5 to 10 years in the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a really late thing for me. That was, you know, probably 26, 27. You know, up until that point, it was college. I knew I had an interest in business. Or, you know, my actual college was about 20 miles away from where I live, my sixth form. So, you know, I didn't make it every day. I remember turning up one day and, you know, I walked in halfway through the lesson and they had my answer to a sort of mock exam, if you like, on the overhead projector.
Okay.
So, you know, I knew that I had something there and it did really interest me. And, you know, we used to learn about the Japanese just-in-time method and all this sort of systems and processes, the way to improve things and to you know, generate revenue systematically really interest me. And so I went to uni and then, you know, after that went traveling. And it was really only when me and my friends went traveling that I actually picked up, I think it was in like Sydney Airport or whatever, Richard Branson's autobiography. And you know, it's quite a chunky one.
Yeah, it is. I've got it. Yeah,
that's it. And I read that, and that went around my mates. And then before the end of the trip, I read it again. And it, that kind of sparked in me, right, you know, this is a journey from, you know, that was the first sort of pre-social media way to really dive into someone's journey and how it can start very, very small and end up almost completely different from the original intention. And so from there, you're really going to the history there, aren't we? So from there...
What did you do at uni, Simon, then? What did you...
Business.
Okay, business. So it's not yeah. anything specific no. with recruitment, like me, yeah, similar yeah. general.
So okay. So after travelling, I came back and the university had a sort of, you know, employment outreach, you know, kind of recruitment office or whatever. And I walked in there and I just said, look, you know, my intention was to set up a business and I wanted to do something in men's clothing, online retailing. So my idea was for 2 years, I was going to earn as much money as humanly possible in 2 years, you know, get some working capital together, stay at home, save up, launch something online sort of thing. So I walked in with this idea. Obviously, I didn't say I was going to be there for 2 years, but I said, look, I just want to make as much money as possible early. And they said, right, well, that's a commission based thing, so that's sales, right? Okay. I said, right, so what's the, you know, the highest commission thing you've got? They said, well, it's probably the most toughest sales role we can have. I was like, that's fine. And it was recruitment. So they then matched me up with this large PLC company, you know, 10 miles down the road. Following Wednesday, got the job. And, you know, actually, you know, no kid leaves school saying, I want to be a recruitment consultant. It's very much something that we all fall into.
Right.
And you either leave within 6 to 12 months because it's very, very tough, or you stick it out if you've got natural personal traits that obviously seem to succeed. And, you know, I did. I was there for 3.5 years. And by year two, I was getting paid a very good sum of money for 2009 and 10 as a 25-year-old, 26-year-old. It was more than my parents had retired on after, you know, 2 years in postgraduate work. So my drive, my hunger to set up a business, it started to fall by the wayside. And, you know, I was keen to, you know, developing this career. And then 2008, 2009 recession happened. And so we were being forced to essentially move internally and, you know, forego all the commission that we built up and things. So myself and a colleague at the time just said, look, you know, if we're asked to be in to start again in a company where we don't necessarily believe in the long-term vision and the working environment, why don't we really start again? And you know, the original intention about setting up a business and what I've been doing for the last 3 years kind of married up, and it was a recruitment company that we set up. So,
and was that your co-founder?
James. That's
James,
right.
At the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, So James and I set up January 2011, and quite quickly after we were joined by two other partners, Alex Kerr, Nick Rowe. And it's really, you know, when they joined is kind of when Carrington West in my mind was born.
If you're enjoying this podcast, can I ask you to do one thing for me? That is to hit the subscribe button. On average, we have just 10% of people who listen to this podcast actually subscribe to it. If you subscribe to it, not only will you be the first person to be notified as soon as any brand new content goes live, it also means that we can go out and get even better guests for the show for you to enjoy. So just take 15 seconds of your time just to hit that subscribe button, and I'll be eternally grateful. Thank you very much.
Tell me about the starting out in your garage. Was it?
Yeah, so it was in my brother's garage.
In your brother's
garage.
It was
my brother's garage. And it was very, very tough. Very, very tough. It was still obviously, the deepest recession since Second World War. Yeah, that's it. And we were told it was a crazy time to set up a recruitment company. It was even crazier to set up a contract recruitment company, which takes far longer to get off the ground. Most recruitment companies are set up to service permanent hires, which are much more, you know, the perm guys at my work will shoot me for this, but it's a much more simple way to get started. So we set up a contract recruitment company in a recession against all advice. And we told my brother, you know, we'll be here for 6 weeks, just in your spare room, in the converted garage down the bottom of his driveway. And we were there for 14 months. And it was really, really tough. We literally started with, two temporary fold out tables. We had, our old slow laptops, two mobile phones, and, you know, in the winter months, which we saw two winters there. We left in the February, the mid February 2012. We had to wear fingerless gloves to stay warm and still type and make calls. So it was that basic of a start. And I think a lot of the time, especially these days, you know, there's a real race on social media to seem and to be seen as being successful way before you are. And I think, you know, my advice would be to really embrace those early days, because it's that struggle that builds the resilience. It's that struggle that builds resilience. And, you know, that's your story. That's your journey that you've been on. But, you know, there's so many people putting up a facade of like early success when that's not true.
No, absolutely. I remember when I was working at Virgin Startup and other Rich's companies, and people were applying for startup loans, and then literally a couple of months later you'd see like blacked out Range Rover with a personalised number plate, and you're like, I can see exactly where that, like, you know, brand new MacBook, iPhone, and you're just like, you don't need that to get going, guys.
No, exactly. But it also, you know, I'm a big one on environment, and if you're flooding your environment with luxury products, all of a sudden, subconsciously, your drive and your hunger is starting to dip. And you know, you've got those things on tick, let's face it, you know. So so we forego you know, any kind of luxury for a long time. And you know, I was still driving around in a £250 Citroen Saxo when we had 7 or 8 staff, you know. So that's what it takes. And you know, these days it's obviously different, but you know, we're talking 13 years later, and it takes, you know, people need to wrap their head around how long this sort of thing takes. You know, again, online you see, do this in 90 days, do this in 3 yeah. months, and it's 10 years. Mm. It's a minimum 10 years, and you want it to take 10 years because if it doesn't take 10 years, you haven't built the skills or the resilience or that kind of, you know, skill thermostat to be able to maintain what's going on. You know, you don't want to be that lottery winner that it comes and goes really quickly.
You need
to mature on that journey. You need it to take that length of time.
And was Carrington West your first business, essentially, your first business venture?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much. There was a kind of lettings website at uni that was just like essentially a hobby that I thought I was going to tackle right move with no budget. Which obviously didn't work. But I think a lot of people are scared to try, and those early sort of dabblings with, you know, complete fantasy kind of outcomes actually built you know, like a resilience to kind of put yourself out there. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know, you need to try a fair few things before something takes off.
And why do you think? Because I was chatting to probably been on the show more than anyone else, Piers Lenny from a Dragon's Den investor, and we were chatting, and he was saying, I think his fourth or fifth business venture was the one that got him in mind. There's like the fourth, I think, with a podcast agency. So interested to know, like, kind of rewind back to start that business. You know, what kind of foundations did you put in place that you think have helped it make it such a, I mean, 100 million revenue business is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. You know, most people listen to this couldn't imagine building a business like that in 13 years or 130 years, Simon. So,
great question. I mean, you know, we were fairly guilty of leaving our permanent versions of the, you know, business related kind of service that we were going to set up, thinking that we knew 90% of the journey. We knew 15-20%, and that was a very, very purposeful, you know, decision to obviously, you know, keep the you know, inner workings of how these things work from us by our PLC employer. They don't want people knowing the, you know, the full life cycle and, you know, going up and setting up sort of thing. So we were, you know, I mean, the year before Christmas 2010, I'd won a national award as the best contract recruiter in the UK. My colleague James was top 3 in a company of 500 that we left. Nick that came on won the award I did the year after. Alex Kerr was, you know, really excellent recruiter. Blaine, who was our first employee, had also won the award I'd won. So we've got 3 national award winners in 4 years in a small room, and we still almost failed. So, you know, my point is, you can be true experts in your field, and if you don't take on, you know, the sort of broad knowledge about how these operations run and really get into the bits that make you feel uncomfortable and really understand it, even if you outsource absolutely everything other than what you're comfortable with at that time, you still need a real grasp on it, because you're outsourcing it to companies that then outsource it to someone else, et cetera, et cetera. So you need to have a really tight grip on the things in the early days, because that can, you know, that can see you come unstuck.
Mm. And when you said you nearly failed, tell us a little bit about that. Yeah. In the early years.
I mean, we can't pin that on Alex, Nick and Blaine. It was very much me and James. We're in the hot seat when that happened.
Right.
But so we got to the summer of the first year. We're obviously still in this, you know, still in the garage. This time it's too hot, not too cold. we'd built up, I mean, that's where that £500 headline comes from. We actually started with £10,000, which was, you know, fairly pitiful savings for two people that had been earning what we'd earning, but you know, we were young lads. But that £500 headline, which, you know, I think it's from the Daily Express or something.
Right.
That was the first amount of money that we were about to pay ourselves monthly.
Got it.
So that we built that up for 6 months to the June. So we thought we'd be paid after about 6 weeks. You know, we're gonna be doing 10K months after 6 weeks. We weren't by any stretch of the imagination. And bear in mind, we're experts at what we do. So it had taken 6 months to build up about £1,000 a month of revenue, which was residual, and we were going to pay ourselves. Now, bearing in mind, you know, I've got a mortgage, James has got a mortgage, and this isn't covering that. So a lot of our lives went on sort of credit cards in that first year. And then we were like, right, you know, this £500 is going to really, really help us. And then one of our former teammates from our previous company became available. We hadn't seen him for about a year. He'd been off doing something else about 6 months to a year before we left. So we hadn't seen him for about a year, 18 months. And he was an excellent recruiter at our previous company. He was got switched off by what he was doing for the last 18 months, wanted to come on board with us. And it was a real, you know, real star signing. So we explained we're still in the garage. We've got these great plans, et cetera, et cetera. Yep, no problem. Don't mind being in the garage for a few months. And came in and for whatever reason, it just didn't work. And I think he'd changed hugely. And I don't think, he no longer believed in it. He'd had children, et cetera, et cetera. And it got to the Christmas, so the December of the first year. And that was probably the lowest point personally that I've had, you know, possibly in my life, certainly my business career. But, if you think 12 months before, we'd had a big, you know, black tie dinner at a 500 people company, and that, you know, and you can see on social media they're still doing that. We're in a pub, decided whether to carry on, and there's three of us, and we said to our colleague, we said, look, you know, we've got two choices. We either all fold this business, or we're going to have to let you go, and James and I carry on, and forego any more salary and just try and grind this out and almost start again. We'd literally run out of funds. We had no choice. And there was various invoicing issues. We thought we'd outsource things to people that had, you know, weren't doing what they said they'd do. And it was a very, very stressful time. And it was real. It was a real, that Christmas was, you know, really difficult. There was some real soul searching going on. I'd be honest, I was looking at jobs back in recruitment. I recently told James that a few years ago. And it was one of those. But you know, in the January, we kind of refocused. You know, it was one of those screw it, let's do it, let's moments, let's say, where we'd spent the last 12 months, building a recruitment business to take on, you know, our previous company and various other companies, you know, nationally, with no brand and no office presence and no, you know, no real revenue and you know, how are we going to do it? You know, it was ridiculous. So we actually almost completely reframed what we were trying to build. We decided that we were no longer going to try and build a recruitment company. We were going to try and build a very, very attractive place to work, to attract top talent, to attract excellent graduates, to attract people that are currently doing it. So we'd be focused on building a recruitment company, and that was now second. We were going to just try and create the best place in the UK to work. That was on our goals. Create the best place in the country to work.
Where did that come from? Who are you looking at that would have somewhere like that anywhere in the world?
So those comparisons came later. But okay. We were like, you know, if we're going to do it, that's our North Star. Let's create an amazing place to work. You know, first things first, we need to change our environment, which we did. And we went to, the sort of best business park locally. It used to be a big IBM building, nice shiny glass thing. And we got like essentially a broom cupboard in there. it was still hugely expensive. And from there, it grew and we looked at everything. We looked at the benefits package. We our first 20 hires were essentially our friends. So it created a real sort of, you know, strong cult environment, you know, culture came from that, and then, you know, from there it kind of grew. And obviously bringing in Alex and Nick helped hugely. They came in with different opinions, different ways of looking at things. Blaine's been unbelievable, and from there it's kind of snowballed. And you know, then we started to get recognised, and then we started to get some heat from my previous company, and you know you're really doing something if they're starting to prod you.
What was that like?
Fun. You know, it's
was it?
Yeah, there's still a few of them there. I mean, you know, I've still got, you know, I can be motivated by, you know, positive things. I can be motivated by quite a darker side. You know, some of the comments and some of the, you know, comments about our business in the early days have literally been burnt onto my brain for the past 13 years. And I'll be honest, it's some of those comments that are probably 20%, you know, to do with my personal success within the business that's got me out of bed and driven it forward.
Yeah.
So thanks, you know, for that. but yeah, no, and it's grown and you know, in November last year, we actually, the investors and people did award us the UK's best employer.
So it didn't take.
Yeah, so it didn't take the 3 or 4 years we thought. It took, as I said, more than a decade, which these things do. And we won that on my 40th birthday. And our head of people, our HR manager, Emily, is with Stephen Bartlett today, with the investors and people as we speak.
Oh, really?
Talking just down the road.
He was sat here last week.
Was he? Oh, yeah. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. you know, and that's all as a result of everyone's hard work and that North Star of trying to create an amazing place to work, constantly trying to improve it. And it really obviously helps with team retention as well.
That was literally going to be my next question. I was just interesting. And like having worked for a big corporate like Virgin Atlantic for many years, the salaries were nothing in comparison to what BA and these other guys were offering.
Yeah.
But everybody wanted to work there and nobody wanted to leave. And it was just, as you say, literally starting and going, okay, so we might not pay fantastically well, but we're going to give you the best benefits package in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, not travel, but also in medical care, not just you, but your family, things like that. And you obviously looked at all those kinds of things. And
everything. I mean, we've just updated it in January, so it's a hugely flexible thing now. But, you know, that's one tool. Mm. I think our biggest tool really has been the creation of the vision that we're trying to drive. You know, the vision that we've got now is obviously very different to the vision that we had even 3 or 4 years ago. But we share that vision internally. We share it internally. Sort of publicly, but internally, and we make sure that, you know, everyone is bought into it. We still see ourselves as a David versus Goliath. That's how I have to operate.
Right.
You know, the minute that I think that, you know, that anyone thinks we've made it, that's the minute you start to die, in my opinion. And you know, we're 110 people, but you know, we're not 500 people, and we're not impacting and helping, you know, thousands of candidates, you know, a month. It's in the hundreds. So you know, there's always room to grow. There's always room to get there. And you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we met as six directors for a whole morning, and we produced a 138 word vision, you know, for the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, salary per word over that time, that's an expensive vision, but that's the value we put on it. And, you know, every single word has to fight hard to be in that vision.
Mm-hmm.
We write it in a moment in time in the future that we can picture being. We write it in the present tense as if it's happened. And we connect with it almost daily in different ways, you know. Mm. So, yes, it might be on the wall, in the kitchen or whatever. But essentially it's talked about, you know, company awards, presentations, you know, each team's got their little vision within the company vision. So the teams connect with their own sort of mini cultures there. And like Virgin, you know, everyone's on a mission to do something.
Mm.
BA were the, you know, they're the, you know, the dusty established, you know, they've done it.
So
it's very, very difficult. It's like Man City. It's very, very difficult to keep winning.
Yeah.
You know, when you're second or third, you're hungry.
Yeah.
And I like to think ourselves as second or third, you know, so keep driving on.
And tell us a little bit about that vision then, because I love what you said there, the fact that you've written it in the present, like you're already there.
Yeah.
This has been achieved. Yep. Where did you get that from? And
we've had various mentors and coaches and things, but one I'd really recommend is Pete Wilkinson. He's written a book called Unstoppable, and he's taken I mean, I don't operate 100% of the way that he does, but he's got a 1-3-5 system, and that's quite common in our business now. Is, you know, that's almost second nature. Everyone says the word, you know, the words 1-3-5. It's one single vision, three key areas that drive towards that vision, and then five goals under each key area.
Yeah.
That's all in his book. But I've taken how he writes that vision and put it into my own framework.
Right.
It you know, being clear on where you're going, and being you know, clear on why you're doing things, and connecting with where you're going, and being able to really concisely share it with the team is very, very important. It's been one of our key factors.
Interesting. And to go back to briefly touch on the past as well, what do you think got you out of bed to keep going? Because when you were either too hot or too cold, and you're having that conversation in the pub, and I'm assuming like friends and family are all looking from the outside in going, well, this isn't working, guys. You had this, you know, glitzy salary before. Look what they're doing this Christmas as well.
Exactly. I think it's that. I think, you know, in my mind, I create, you know, what I call an NFC. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah,
which is a no fucking choice situation. And it is amazing what you can achieve when in your mind you've created a scenario where there is no choice. You know, so in the early days, to fund the expansion and to fund our contract to payroll and things, we had to invoice discount, we had to factor, and you know, all recruitment companies do. But those figures in the early days were you know, quite scary for someone with a £250 car. So our only assets that the bank would take on our personal guarantees on that were our homes. So once you've got, you know, your flat on the line that you've worked, you know, really hard to try and buy, you can do anything. So, you know, my advice is to try and think, you know, how you can create a sort of no choice situation without really putting yourself in harm's way. That can be social stigma. A lot, you know, we had 500 people at our previous business. There was only one or two people that had done what we'd done in the last 30 years and split away and think that they can do things in a slightly more improved manner. So we had a lot of eyes on us. We had a lot of friends there. We had a lot of, you know, a lot of interesting comments from the, you know, from the management. We had friends and family who we just told that we were going to, you know, absolutely tear things up 12 months prior. You know, people forget that in the Western world, we operate in a capitalist environment. You know, in the early days, people, they might leave, you know, a nice review. They might share something on their Instagram stories. That is 0.001%, you know, of your support network.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people out there they don't want to see you win. That's capitalism. So it becomes a real shock that once you move out of your sort of social bubble where everyone's cheerleading you, no one else wants you to win.
No.
So it's really difficult. So you need to, you know, sometimes it's a case of toughening up. And you know, I mean, as I said, personally, I'm driven by a much darker, you know, way to try and, you know, prove people wrong. Essentially, that's what I've always done.
Okay. Clearly, the last, say, 10 years or so since that initial setback couldn't have been plain sailing.
No. Yeah.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you faced in that time? Because then once you've gotten over that initial, you know, tough place that you were in, and then you start building, you start growing the team, you start actually bringing some revenue in, but nothing lasts forever, and you're going to hit a roadblock.
Yeah.
What kind of roadblocks did you guys hit?
Yeah, so we've had many. We've had some bad debts. We've had clients, you know, going to administration. Obviously we had the, you know, the pandemic. And obviously I don't want to bore people with with what we did during the pandemic, but I think there's a good lesson there. Most of our competitors were mass furloughing their teams, which, you know, they were entitled to do. We decided not to. So we only furloughed, I think we had 60 people at the time, and we furloughed, you know, a handful. And that was usually, you know, single parents or people that just literally couldn't operate from home, or parts of the business, you know, whatever that, you know, that didn't need to operate. but we kept everyone fully engaged, fully paid, you know, and you know, motoring on. And that was a really tough 6 months. You know, you had brand new consultants that, you know, had hardly had any training face to face with, now in their parents' spare bedroom trying to learn it remotely. It was almost impossible. But some of our emerging markets had teams of 15 or 20 people. We've got a team of three trying to take on 15 or 20 people. And a lot of recruitment is outbound daily activity. Mm. You can imagine every day that we're playing against 20 people over here and we've got three, we're losing. We're losing ground by definition.
Mm.
So, you know, it took some persuasion, especially, you know, from James to certainly me and to some of the other guys, because it was a calculated risk. And, you know, our finance director was bringing up spreadsheets, you know, on Zoom, and I'm not a financial guru, but I know that, you know, green or black is good and red's bad. Yeah. And you can see it goes quite red. you know, if they stand all their team down and we've got three or four here and they're going, all of a sudden we're gaining ground. And that is once in a generation opportunity to gain ground on a team that stood down.
Mm.
All of a sudden you're playing on a pitch, they haven't got a goalkeeper. So it was a different take on it. And we actually grew by 7% during the pandemic, which is crazy because, you know, most recruitment companies were halving. And out of that, we were like an arrow that was drawn back. You know, we worked on, you know, we weren't overrun with you know, vacancies to work, for sure. So we upskilled the team. We worked on our remote training. We brought in an online training facility with video, which you know, won us the Investors in People best UK best training platform. You know, the previous winners of that were Lloyds Bank. Mm. You know, we really looked at every facet of the business, whereas everyone else took a bounce back loan and went out and bought a jet ski. Like, you know, once the ramp up, you know, we flew with that market and we rode that wave, and we're in different times now, but you know, the lessons we learned from you know, observing what everyone else was just seemed to be doing, and just, you know, and not being reckless, but slightly changing tax has meant that we've doubled since that time.
Have you really?
Yeah, we've doubled.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting. It's funny, like when you said buy a jet ski, and one of the other things I thought of was, like, you know, learn to play the guitar, buy a guitar. Because I was interviewing the CEO of Fender, and during the pandemic, they went from 400 million to a billion.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like, that initial couple of months, though, he goes, you know, we just thought this is Armageddon, because everyone who's touring, all of the shops are shut, all the musicians aren't touring anymore.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, everyone's at home, everyone's bored, I want to learn to play a musical instrument or buy a jet ski.
And what better, you know, what better guitars to buy than the Ferrari of guitars, you know?
Exactly.
That's the sort of person that wants to learn on a Fender.
Yeah.
It's the sort of person that's going to buy it. So, yeah, fair enough.
Well, I love that story of what you did at that time, because I remember thinking at the time, literally, like, all of our clients for the podcast agency just furloughed everybody, and there wasn't even anyone to have a conversation with about marketing their podcast. And you can understand that a podcast is going to go, you know, way down in the list of priorities. It was like in the last recession, Virgin Atlantic, they got rid of all the beauty therapists. You know, my wife was one of the 300 they got rid of, because it was like, we could still fly an airplane from A to B. You don't need a massage or a manicure or a facial to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that you took the time and you thought, you know, that analogy of you're prepared to do what the competition isn't doing.
Yeah.
You know, what's everyone else doing? Well, they're at home. What can we do? Mm. And get better.
Yeah, exactly.
Can upskill the team. I love that. Yeah. It was like chatting to Eugene Emadadze before, the sprinter I was telling you about, and he said, you know, the first time he got an injury, injured his hamstring, and he was like, he said, I threw all my toys out of my pram. I was like raging. I was like eating all the wrong foods. I was really pissed off. Then he thought, I actually could use this opportunity that I'm going to be out for 3 or 4 months to get better. So I'm going to be the best sleeper. I'm going to be the best recovery. I'm going to be best at nutrition, so that when I came back 4 months later, I was actually further ahead of the curve than the rest of my competition. They were all just still treading water.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also, you know, it's the building of the habit of better sleep.
Yes.
And it's the, you know, you can always control. There's five or six things that you can always control. And, you know, what I've really learned since having children, actually, is that you know, momentum is not something that's caught. It's not an external factor. I always used to think it was, you know, I was waiting for that sort of push of motivation.
Yeah.
It comes from within and you can create it. And for me, it's no alcohol. You know, I go, you know, months without alcohol sometimes. He says, going on a stag do to Belgium tomorrow at 6 a.m.
good luck.
But yeah, exactly. How can I get out of it? But you know, it's no alcohol. It's getting to bed early, and it's exactly that. There you can control the controllables, and from there the momentum builds if you've got that strong vision that you're driving towards.
Yeah, agreed. And it's doing those small actions every day that actually build the momentum.
Yeah.
You can't just start from ground zero and expect that rock to keep rolling in your direction,
exactly,
can you?
Yeah.
And then what do you think is interesting, because you had that original vision, you reframed that vision. So how important is it on being crystal clear in that vision, having just gone through that exercise again by the sounds of things as well?
Yeah, so I think...
For someone starting out, you know...
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny, when you... If you're on a 10-year journey, which I think people should frame, you know, if you're in the first couple of years and you're looking and you're wondering why it's not happening yet, it is happening. You're just 20% down the road, you know. So your first vision or your first set of goals that you write, you'll look back and you'll laugh, you know. And some, I've still got our sort of first goals that we wrote in the first, you know, few days of being in that garage, and they are laughable. But I keep them there because at the time they were lofty.
Mm.
So it will never end up, you know, they'll either seem ridiculously small or... You just won't end up on that same path. But it's the first few steps of a journey. But I think being as specific as you can with the knowledge you've got at that time, and, you know, not being too scared to think much, much bigger than you currently are.
Mm.
I truly believe, you know, if you're looking to, you know, grow revenue to a million, you know, look to grow it to 5, and you might get, you know, you might get to 1.6 a lot quicker than you would have done. You know, human beings have got a way of kind of, you know, most of us, me included sometimes, have got a way of just, you know, saying that'll do about 75% of what we're looking to do.
Yeah.
So just make it bigger. The Magic of Thinking Big, great book. It's coming up 70 years old now or whatever. And it's, you know, that changed my life. That's well worth reading or listening to if people want to. And it's a case of being as specific as you can. I like to pick future events. You know, annually we have a big team Christmas party, and it's, you know, I pick Christmas parties. I know the venue it's going to be in, and I can picture walking in, looking back at the year I've had, and am I going to be pleased with myself and looking to grow further, or am I going to walk in there and not really enjoy it?
Yeah.
And you can look down, you can see who you're with, you can picture the conversations you're going to have, and it's about being, you know, a bit Marty McFly about it. You know, you need to execute in the day. You need to be very, very clear on what you need to do that day. And when you're all in, you're all in. But, you know, 75% really is in the present moment and execution, you know, and there's at least 20% of going back to the future, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you need at some point during that day or at least that week to be connecting with the future vision. But not too much of that, you're not executing here. Too much of this, you're a hamster in a wheel.
Yeah.
And the remaining sort of 5% or whatever is glancing back. Don't spend too much time looking back, but you know, you need to see how far you've come, because it's the pat on the back that we all need sometimes, especially when you're feeling a bit low.
Yeah.
But also you need to look back for lessons that you know, that you've learned to try and tweak going forward in that daily execution. So that's kind of the ratios where I try and keep myself.
Mm.
But it's about flitting between the future and the present.
Yeah, interesting. I like that. I haven't heard it framed like that before. Do you think, or can you pinpoint any key turning points over the last 13 years?
I think changing our environment each time has been a big push, interestingly. Yeah.
That
so we've had 5 or 6 versions of our office. And I know, you know, we're dinosaurs now for our large office. I know that from quite a few of our competitors, but we did expand our office in January. So we've got 160 seats, and you know, when you walk in, it's like that's our home stadium. That's our, you know, you're not going to beat us here. And it's that kind of environment that we want to create. We want people to feel at home and relaxed, and they want we want people to feel excited about coming to work. But each turn, you know, each time we've moved into a new office, and I remember walking into one where we had 20 seats once, and I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. We're paying too much. We're not going to fill it. And each time we change our environment, you know, people are refocused, and there's been those mini changing points. And physically, people can see what you've been bleating on about for weeks and months starting to come to fruition. And then, you know, there's less eye rolling when you're saying we're going to do this in the future.
As I said, there's
been what could be negative things that we've reframed as positive things. So all these, even the pandemic was, in theory, pretty good for business, you know, because of our actions during that. So there's been some turning points each time.
Okay. And you're taking the company from where it was to where it is now as a £100 million company. Would you say you're personally where you want to be?
No. I wouldn't say that. You know, I think it's. I mean, for me, I haven't even started. You know, that's you know, really my own personal vision for my own life is it's obviously it's changed. You know, I've got a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, got a loving partner. You know, we live in a nice house, but I certainly don't feel like I've even got going.
Really?
And I think that's the issue in the UK. The issue in the UK is people are like, when are you going to sell up? You know, when are you going to exit?
Yeah.
So, well, what for?
What's
it? So I can go on holiday and lie on the beach. Well, I've just come back from Mallorca last week. I was bored. Not bored, Lucy. I had a lovely time. But, exactly. No, keep it. Fine. She won't listen to it. If you look around Europe, people build companies that then, you know, stay with the family members, or they're passed on, and you know, shares are sold, and but you still remain a key partner. And you know, if you look at Estee Lauder and companies like this, these large, you know, companies have stayed in the families, and they've become huge organizations. And I think in the UK, a lot of people build these businesses and they sell them before they've even got going, and it's that's not what we're going to do. You know, we're going to grow this, and we're going to push it as far as we can.
Are you? Okay, interesting. So do you know, where you want to be, where you want to get to with that vision?
Well, I mean, it changes all the time, but I mean, I suppose our next, you know, from 1 to 10 took a number of years in terms of headcount. 60 to 100 seems like the blink of an eye. So, you know, we want to get our business to, you know, 200 people business. We want to, you know, we want to really start to own the markets in which we operate. You know, we own a few. I think our brand's strong. And, you know, we want to create careers for our people. We want to affect, you know, the community in which we're in, which is in Portsmouth. You know, it's a working class town. And, you know, they've taken away various, you know, they've taken the shipbuilding away. They've done various things. You know, it's a town that's been regenerated somewhat, but I think, you know, if there was more companies like us in towns like that around the country, the UK would be a very different place. You know, my role in recruitment has taken me to every small town and city in the country, and I've been all over. I won't name the ones because it might seem that I'm talking down on them, but outside of the, you know, your Londons and your and even your main northern hubs, Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, most small towns in the UK are not good. They're struggling. And I think, you know, by my next, you know, me 2.0 is trying to give as much of the information that we've learned away as possible.
Yes.
You know, I'm as active as I can be on Instagram. I've got a website. I've produced lots and lots of content for the local university, and I've been giving talks to try and upskill those people, the university that I used to go to. And I thought, you know, how can I get this information to people that can't afford 10 grand a year to go to uni, minimum course fees? So I've been looking at, you know, the Level Out, Level Up program, as you mentioned.
Yes.
That is very much at, you know, the, you know, young adults that seem a bit lost. But there's a whole plethora of people in the middle that, you know, I mean, I read a stat the other day, 64% of the UK, the employed members of the UK workforce want to start their own company. They just don't, either haven't got, something's lacking, isn't it? It's either motivation, drive, confidence, finance, whatever. So even if we can convert another 3 or 4% of those, that's what this country's built on.
That's massive, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, I think entrepreneurialism and good entrepreneurialism and the employment that creates and the well-intended, people out there that can set up, good businesses, offer good careers, that's how we're going to get out of this mess, I think.
Interesting. Okay. No, I was really interested having a read about that program and who is affected, like those people who literally, they might have these dreams, but they can't envisage how they're going to get there because they're, I don't know, in some kind of purgatory when it comes to their lives.
Yeah. We've all been in that. We know exactly what that feels like.
Yeah, no, likewise, going back, absolutely. Thinking back when, the last recession, I took voluntary redundancy, and then it's like, what do you do next? And that year's salary never lasts a year that they give you either.
No, you still spend it at the same rate, don't you?
So to finish up, Simon, then kind of a natural point there. What piece of advice would you give to somebody to help them get from where they are to where they want to be? And that can be, you're given a couple of really good book recommendations. Yeah. It could be a quote. It could be something physical, some personal advice. What would you say?
Yeah. So I'm going to give a third book, and it is a Dan Martell book.
Mm-hmm.
And my business mentor Shah Wasmond. So when she recommends me a book, it's one of her mates had written it. So she went, "Oh, my mate's written a New York bestseller. You should read it." So I was like, "Fair enough." But I think that is an excellent book. It's called "Buy Back Your Time," and it's really for people that are and it's so scalable, which is why I'm suggesting it. So if you've if you've just started and you've got maybe one or two a team of one or two people, or you're like a solopreneur and you're looking to grow, it really gives you a blueprint for how to start to step back at each step of the way and essentially get out of your own way. If you've got 50 people, it'll work. I read it about 2-3 months ago. I'm going to read it again before the year's out. It offers you advice about how to create, online video playbooks so that you can induct people into your business. Everyone can sing off the same hymn sheet. It talks about delegation, vision setting, scheduling. And it really would help people just stuck about how they're too involved in certain areas of their business or, their life, when really they should be offering that attention to other people. And I think it's a superb book. And I think if as I said, it works for the person with one or two, and it works for the people with 100. So it's a really scalable book, and I'd suggest reading that.
Like it. I haven't read it myself. I know who he is, so I'll read that one. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Get it. Brilliant. Well, look, Simon Gardner, thank you very much indeed for being a guest.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, and screw it and just do it. Until next time.